Welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute, where we offer a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Emma Ashford, a research fellow here at Cato.
And I'm Trevor Thrall, a senior fellow at Cato.
Today, we're broadening our focus to look not just at one country, but at a whole region. We'll be discussing America's future in the Middle East with our guest, Brian Katulis. Brian's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and his extensive experience studying and working in the Middle East, including stints at the Departments of Defense, State, and at the National Security Council. So thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
As always, let's get started by talking a little about some of this week's news. And I should say that we're recording this perhaps a couple of weeks ahead of where you'll hear it. So we're going to try and talk about general news stories. And I think one of the more interesting stories this week is that a group of lawmakers, including Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, are proposing legislation that would pre-constrain the president's ability to start a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, and particularly a nuclear conflict. This seems like kind of an interesting approach.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think if you think about President Donald Trump and you think about his experience as a businessman and as a businessman who actually went through bankruptcy, in many ways, I think Republicans and Democrats look at this president as an administration that needs to have its foreign policy placed in receivership, if you will, in strict oversight in the way that a bankrupt company actually is. And this is not a partisan statement. You hear concerns from Republicans and Democrats alike about not just the president's mercurial nature, but his inability to actually execute a policy that actually advances stability and U.S. interests in the long run.
Yeah, that's – I mean, you hear that sort of on a daily basis, this notion that there need to be more responsible adults and more boundaries set for Mr. Trump. The question I have, though, is what kind of pre-constraints that Congress might impose are realistically going to actually burden Mr. Trump if he decides to go sort of full, you know, crazy.
And it doesn't seem like this, and I know we're recording this a bit early, but he'll be out in Asia for about a week and a half. And as I understand, I think we're sending a third nuclear-powered aircraft into the region as well. And what we've seen over the last 30, 40 years has been this expansion of executive authority, the ability to take action without much oversight from Congress. So I haven't read the legislation. I think the instinct seems good to try to constrain. It's sort of like when you take your kid bowling and you want to put those sort of bumpers up so he doesn't roll a gutter ball. I think that's what Congress is trying to do here. But Trevor's right. What impact will it actually have, given that we've had this supercharged, you know, presidency, not only under Trump, but executive authority being able to do so much?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. Given Congress's sort of abdication of its responsibilities with regard to war powers in recent years, I mean, it almost seems like we are trying to move into a situation where right now the president sort of tries to lump in everything under the 2001 AUMF, and you know, sometimes it seems like it's justified. And so they're at least nodding to the idea that Congress has given permission. But if they were to put something like this into place and Trump took action, that would be just a clear violation of he doesn't care what Congress thinks.
Yeah. No, and I think that's pretty clear. He on many issues, he doesn't care what Congress thinks, and that should scare a lot of people. I think another thing that worries me when it comes to this issue of congressional versus executive authority, when you have members of Congress like we heard today, Senator Lindsey Graham saying that the individual who conducted this attack on October 31st in Manhattan should be charged as an enemy combatant. And again, this is somebody who is on U.S. soil. And when you think about what the lesson should have been that we learned post 9/11 about Guantanamo and detentions and other things, it certainly shouldn't be we should have more enemy combatants because a lot of these people have not been brought to justice.
Yeah, no, this I think is an entirely fascinating conversation that we should probably have a whole episode on at some point. But let's move on to the second issue of the day, and that's the specter of secessionism is haunting Europe. And in particular, we've seen the government of Spain moving to reimpose direct rule on Catalonia following this contentious independence referendum. It does sort of seem like secessionist movements are gathering steam over there.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it's sort of a strange timing. It's not obvious to me why now exactly, but it's obviously And maybe Brexit sort of stirred some additional hopes and dreams elsewhere. But I think in both cases, sadly, because I think you know both the Kurds and the Catalonians have good arguments for greater independence. But in both cases, I think they miscalculated and picked a sort of a strategy that is not ready to work at this time.
Yeah, and I see the situation in Spain similar to what the Kurds are experiencing, but also similar to what's happening inside of Europe, which is a crisis of confidence in democratic structures, a crisis of political legitimacy in some ways. And I think all of this does relate to what has been a growing incoherence in terms of the internal politics of many democratic countries. And then there's this broader trend, which we talk about all the time here in Washington. But it's not just Russia. It's also China. It's the very assertive involvement of authoritarian powers using very sophisticated tools to try to spin up sort of divisions in societies. I think in some ways it's overplayed, but it certainly is actually a factor and a structural factor in geopolitics today.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, from my point of view, I sort of look at it and say, well, those divisions were there anyway. And you're right that, that countries like Russia can exploit them. But I think, you know, growing up in Scotland, I'll tell you, Scottish independence as a sentiment has been around for decades, but it's always been a fairly marginal thing. It's never really been successful. And it was only in the run-up to the independence referendum a couple of years ago that we started to see larger support. And I think that does have something to do with what you're talking about here, this crisis of confidence in Western democracy. Some of these movements have been around for decades, but they're getting more attention now, partly because of Russian meddling and partly because there are these societal problems that people aren't seeing solved.
Yeah, and I think as Trevor said, it's partially, I think, related to Brexit and some of the economic issues and the certain sense of we're at a phase in globalization where a lot of people felt like they were left behind. But then there's a related issue, which is this rise of us versus them identity politics, which I've seen, you know, from India to Israel to Europe, and now we see here in the United States. And in some ways, you know, some of that is healthy if it's channeled into positive sort of clear-eyed thinking about solutions, but a lot of it right now feels like it's just angry lashing out against the other and defining the other in ways that are unhelpful that actually accelerates the divisions inside of societies.
Well, shifting topics again, but perhaps staying within the realm of nationalism, the Chinese Communist Party Congress just wrapped up, and they did some really interesting things this time. They enshrined Xi Jinping's name and his vision in the constitution. That's something that's only previously been done for Mao when he was alive and Deng Xiaoping after he died. And in his speech at the conference, Xi Jinping spoke of a new era in Chinese politics, and this was the thing that really got to me. He spoke about the reemergence of China as a global great power. Sort of seems like we missed this in the middle of all the Trump madness.
Yeah, I think China maybe is just saying, raising their hand and saying, "Hey, don't forget, we're here and we're big and we're going to be number one for a long time, and you might want to pay attention again." After you're done with all the silly stuff over there.
Yeah. I went to Beijing the last time in spring of 2015, and I went with a Center for American Progress delegation headed by John Podesta. He had just come out of the White House, and it was before he became the campaign chair to Hillary Clinton. And he was there to follow up on some discussions on the climate agreement. There was this climate agreement. But we were there also to talk about Middle East. And what struck me, big picture point, was that in China, they were thinking about the next 100 years and building things globally. Whereas the region of the world that I've focused on a lot is thinking about the last 1,000 years and blowing things up. And it was quite a contrast. And when you think about China's steady march and the steady rise, I actually feel like a lot of focus these days, understandably, is on Russia. I see Russia more like a troll power. It has been trolling in many ways and trying to undermine its adversaries, but not offering a clear alternative model. Whereas China does present itself as this alternative model, one that I don't agree with, one that is much more authoritarian, but talks about economics and projection of economic power. But it's, I think, a steadier, slower game that I frankly think many U.S. administrations, especially this one, don't really know how to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, because Russia is a declining power. No matter what it may look like, they're actually not as threatening as we might think. But China has been, as Trevor says, very quiet, and sort of this seems to be them finally starting to assert themselves. A little more.
If you look at Chinese public opinion, they're feeling very assertive these days, very confident in the Chinese project. And I think this, you know, their foreign policy in their near border regions and so on is a good reflection of the fact that they feel much more comfortable exerting themselves on the world stage than they ever have. And Brian, you mentioned the various sort of massive infrastructure projects that they're planning and proposing and implementing around the world, and you know, Middle East, Africa, and so on. These are folks who are very serious about, you know, making a difference on the world stage. The thing that troubles me is that, to go back to the party Congress, is that unfortunately, you know, sort of this cult of personality that they're enshrining tells you that in some ways less has changed in China than you might have wanted to see. All the economic progress has not translated into much liberalization when it comes to you know, the way they imagine people should rule themselves. And so, you know, I think that's bad news long run for the rest of the world, because to the extent that China can impose or show that as a role model, I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. And if you look at the excessive crackdown on freedoms at home, it does sort of belie the confidence that it has when it projects power overseas. It also relates to the point we were talking about in America and in other established democracies. I remember President Clinton actually selling the case for bringing China in the WTO and permanent normal trade relations. And I actually think we haven't had as much of a debate about that and the implications of it and what it means, because this model, this hope that many people had that if you bring them onto the economic grid and globalization, it would produce some sort of change internally, just turned out not to be true. And it actually also hurt many people in the United States, you know, in terms of the economic structures and other things.
Yeah, the failure of a modernization theory for those who study comparative development. On that happy note, let's move on. And before we get to our main topic, I want to ask you our surprise question of the day, which
sure.
At this point's not really a surprise. But I'd ask you, you know, what do you think the most overhyped threat to the U.S. is, and what do you think the threat is that's there, but we're not really talking about?
I think it may be odd in terms of overhype to say this the day after a terrorist attack in Manhattan. But when you look at sort of the basic statistics of what makes Americans unsafe and what makes, you know, what is a real threat, it is not Islamist terrorism, which is the thing that we dedicate hundreds of billions of dollars each year to defend against. Yes, there are threats out there, but to put it in proportion, I think, you know, there were 30,000 total terrorist attacks globally in the world, and about 75% of them were concentrated in 10 countries. So far fewer Americans are threatened by this issue. But the way it's dealt with in our politics, the way we react to tragedies and awful instances like the attack on October 31st in Manhattan, it sort of is a knee-jerk response where we dedicate far too many resources and not to the things that I think are under-discussed. Look, I think the things that actually do kill Americans, I consider a national security threat. The opioid crisis and gun deaths kill about 100,000 Americans each year. 100,000. That is a public safety and national security crisis that has some foreign policy implications, especially on drugs that come into this country. And a second, I think, under-discussed challenge or threat. It's out there. It comes every few weeks. We see some sort of hack or things like this. But cybersecurity, I actually feel like, is somewhere in our consciousness as a genuine threat. But we in the foreign policy realm have not really married up with the internet security folks to think about how this is actually altering the state of geopolitics, how it's changing the nature of state-to-state relations, how it's accelerating national security crises, and actually leading to the sorts of things that we talked about in democracies, a greater sense of disarray and disunity. So these hacks and hacktivists and countries backing them actually have had a huge impact on geopolitics in a way that we haven't yet strategically absorbed and haven't even begun to think about an effective policy response to.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think there really just aren't good models for understanding how we study this, talk about this kind of thing yet. So thank you for that. Let's move on to our main topic of the day, because your expertise is in the Middle East, and I want to make sure we spend a lot of time on that. Where to start with the Middle East? It's certainly pretty messy at the moment, has been for a number of years. And I was interested to hear that you're working on a project on what you described as drivers of regional instability. And so let me just start by asking you, what do you think are the region's main problems? What is driving instability today and perhaps in the future?
Well, this is not going to be a shocking headline because we've been told this years ago. But the drivers of instability in the Middle East are endemic to the region. It's the lack of investment in social and economic and educational futures. So if you remember the 2002 Arab UN Human Development Report, which came out, there are a whole list of challenges that I think have bubbled up and threatened the state system in the Middle East. And it's not the usual sets of factors we think about, terrorism or ISIS or even some of the states in the region like Iran. It is these crushing demographic and economic challenges that, again, the UN Human Development Report of 2002 highlighted, and 15 years later, it's gotten worse. So Center for American Progress is doing this project with the American Enterprise Institute. It'll produce a book next year. We've been traveling the region together. And it's less about what should the U.S. do. That's what most of these think tank reports. It's more looking at the region as it stands on its own and what can be done to actually promote greater stability that is organic, that is not imposed from the outside, that is certainly not the result of some sort of military campaign. And a lot of it comes back to a lot of the basic things that help make societies tick. Do you have an educated populace? Do you have a legal system that works? Do you have governance? Do you have anti-corruption measures? Those sorts of building blocks, which we don't talk about anymore because I think the Bush administration and its freedom agenda discredited a lot of it in its execution, really still are at the core of the challenges in many of the top countries in the Middle East.
Yeah, my insights into Middle Eastern politics are not many. However, one of the things I do know from some work I've been doing is just how young the Middle East is as a region. 50% or more of most of the Middle Eastern countries are, folks under 30. And when you have a youth bulge like that, you put such a strain on society to absorb those folks into the economy, into society, because they're different from their parents and their grandparents. They want to do different things. These kids are growing up in a globalized world with very different pictures in their heads of what should be normal and what they might want for their futures. And they're clashing with these very authoritarian governments who are not interested in making allowances for these things. And so, I thought the Arab Spring was sort of the first big, hole in the dam. Do you think there's a bigger hole coming? Is that where these instabilities are going, or is it just going to sort of continue being messy forever?
I think it's inevitable. I mean, it's 7 years after the Arab uprisings began in Tunisia and then in Egypt, more or less. And the structural factors have not changed. What we've seen, especially since 2013 or so, has been this, it's like the Empire Strikes Back, the authoritarian states sort of clawing back very aggressively and pushing back against any openness in places like Egypt and other places. But it's not all grim. You look at Tunisia or, for instance, I'll tell you a story. Michael Rubin of AEI and I were in Morocco, and we were doing this roundtable about 50 college students in Rabat. And we asked this question of how is your generation different from your parents' generation? And this woman, the head covering, said, hey, we've got gay and lesbian people here, and we talk about it, and we debate what that is. And then they proceeded for 20 minutes to actually fight with each other about how open it was. But the debate wasn't there was a debate. It wasn't like, as in parts in Syria or maybe even Iraq where they're throwing them off of buildings because of their identity. There was, I think, a broader acceptance of freedom. So I think the previous decade when the U.S. engaged largely with a focus on electoral processes and trying to tie our global war on terror to a freedom agenda, it was bound to fail, and it especially failed in places like Iraq, where we had too much of a militaristic approach. But you know, I think there are other ways that we can seek to engage, because there's still fertile territory for change. People don't like living in authoritarian societies where there's injustice, and we're not going to be the agents for that. But we shouldn't be in the way that I think President Donald Trump has, sort of standing back and letting it all be. I think we need to actually think of new modes of engagement that are largely in the non-military space, that aren't expensive, that actually can pay dividends in the long run, because change is inevitable in that part of the region. The question is, do we want it to move forward, or do we want it to go back 1,000 years like some of the groups like ISIS wanted to do?
Yeah. So I think this actually is a really great pivot into our next question, which is, you know, what is the U.S. role in all of this? As you say, our role in the last 10, 15 years has been pretty heavily military. And even though we often paid lip service to this freedom agenda, the idea that we were spearheading democratic processes, we've often fallen back on the military option. And in many cases, I would say probably prevented freedom and liberty from actually growing in some of these places where we've intervened. So you've referred to America's role in the future in the region as being a security integrator. Perhaps you could explain, you know, what do you mean by that? What is this role?
Yeah, and that I think comes from a phrase from a report we put out about a year ago called Leveraging U.S. Power in the Middle East. And I did it with some colleagues, and it was an attempt to sort of look broad brush at what the role of the Middle East, U.S. should be in the Middle East. And if you look at it, since the 1980s, essentially, we've been sinking ourselves more deeply in terms of a security and military footprint, and in superficial ways trying to, you know, create incentives for societies to perform and change in the way that I think is very important. And I think the thrust of where America should go is to continue to step back from trying to basically control outcomes, because we can't in the Middle East, and take the energies, which are largely negative, of many of our closest partners and then certainly our adversaries, and try to focus them more on what does a sustainable security system look like. And I mean that from a military sense, but I also mean it from a human development sense. And again, here we're talking sort of fantasy land under 9 months into the Trump administration, because what I'm talking about is normative, what I think would be ideal. It's not going to happen under President Trump. We can conclude that already. And then based on my visits, especially the last few weeks, to some of our closest allies in the region, they're already starting to discount our presence. Meaning, you know, and it's not just the gap between what they hoped we would do and what Trump is actually doing. It's they see the disarray inside of the Trump administration. So back to the security integrator point is that we should try to, instead of just giving handouts and selling weapons and security training and assistance, we should do it with a strategy that has a goal of the U.S. actually fading back a bit and letting others try to take control of their own destiny. That should be the goal. And unfortunately, I think since the Carter Doctrine of the 1980s, we've been on autopilot and sort of all in and more deeper and deeper. And lo and behold, the region is actually not structurally all that safer.
I couldn't agree more with you, honestly. I give this lecture to our interns once a year, and it basically is sort of just a history of mission creep going back to the Carter Doctrine. If you actually look at troop numbers in the region, for example, in the Middle East, you basically see that every year since the end of the Gulf War, we've pretty much increased our commitment across the board in the region. So I agree with you that this is a problem. But it does seem that there are perhaps some inherent tensions in the approach that you talk about, and basically trying to work to improve outcomes in the region, perhaps on a humanitarian side, on a development side, while maintaining security cooperation of some kind.
Yeah, I think it's hard to do, and I think sometimes in our debate here in Washington and especially in Congress, it's presented as an all or nothing prospect. And the theme of this report, and again, it guides a lot of my work, is that the U.S. actually has a lot more leverage that it just leaves on the table, and especially with some of our closest allies. And it's not just human development and soft things like this. It is driving towards a diplomatic resolution to conflicts like Yemen or Syria and places like this, where we need to marry up our security tools, and that is the leverage of our security tools, not only just giving it away to close partners and allies, but having those important conversations to say, how does what we're doing together, jointly, in places like Syria or Yemen, actually latch up to the longer-term vision of stability? And maybe that's too high of an ideal, but I think it's important to try to do this. What's happened under President Trump, unfortunately, is that I think we've just ceded a lot of that potential leverage. In Syria, we've allowed Iran and Russia to set the terms of some sort of peace negotiation, and I actually don't think that's a great recipe for long-term stability. And in Yemen, we've basically continued to offer a blank check to partners like Saudi Arabia. So what I'm saying is probably more nuanced than is capable in a political or even policy debate here in Washington today, especially under Trump, is that we should actually give it a try to try to shape the actions of our partners and do it, you know, in a serious way. I don't for a moment think it's going to happen under President Trump. So it begs the question of then, okay, do we just fade back, and then what will the outcomes be?
Yeah, I think you know, the practical question is what's possible now, and you know, nothing under Trump probably is the real answer. But like, say the next president isn't Trump, what could he or she do? And I think step back. I love hearing the phrase, since that's the title of one of my recent policy analyses. So I'm with you there. But to me, the only way that the United States can really be a credible mediator or integrator or really play a useful and non-counterproductive role in the Middle East is if it really does do what you said, which is forego trying to control outcomes, mm-hmm. because that is the nut of what the United States has been trying to do. It wants the right outcome in Yemen. It wants a specific outcome in Syria, although it doesn't even know what that is. It wants the right people in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and so on and so forth. And you know, in my reading of history, that is not something that any one country has the power to dictate. And trying to do so for the last 16 years, most obviously, has led to nothing but trouble and a worse mess. And so my hope would be that your strategy, we could start down that path by just getting the heck out and saying, guys, we're not trying to dictate anymore. We, of course, we have preferences, but we're not going to lean in on one side of these fights or another. I think, unfortunately, I mean, you might think Yemen is a mess or Syria is a mess, but until we say, look, it's just not our call.
Yeah.
I just feel like, why does anyone there trust us?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And the one place I would say we may disagree, but maybe not terribly too much, is that I think if the U.S. doesn't have a plan for stepping back or how it might even try to use its leverage, you could have outcomes like we've seen for the last 4 or 5 years in Syria, which some analysts would say, oh, well, it's contained. It's not our issue. It's over there. I would argue actually the strategic consequences to global security, to politics in places like Europe, politics even in our country about refugees, immigration, and things like this actually have their seeds in that. And if you look back, you know, on things that I wrote, again, maybe I sound a little too conflicted, but I hope I'm clear. I think in 2013-14, I was really hesitant and reticent about the U.S. getting involved in places like that. But as the crisis continued to have a huge strategic cost, I think, not only for the Middle East, but then for Europe and then other places, and had knock-on effects, and then the human costs, and this is where we may disagree, I felt like there was more that we could be doing on the margins. Again, I wasn't in favor of like a nationwide no-fly zone and things like this. But we got into a situation towards the end of the Obama administration who President Obama, I think, signaled in a strategic way sort of when he first went in, an era of new engagement. We're going to use diplomacy. And then by 2011, there was very mixed responses to the Arab uprisings. And after a few months, it was clear sort of the authoritarian sort of backlash we weren't going to do much about. But then by the time we rounded the corner, and more specifically to Syria, President Obama had promised a number of different things to different actors, and then I think quite cynically did not deliver on those promises, thus accelerating this crisis of efficacy of the U.S. in the Middle East. So we are where we are now. And my main point, though, is that I think if you just leave the field and abandon it without trying even in small ways to use your leverage with current actors like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and other things, it could actually get a lot worse. There may be a period of trying to work with and reassure allies on the one hand, but as a means to get leverage to shape their actions. Otherwise, the sort of carpet bombing and the things like this that we see every day from Russia could even be more devastating. And it's not just the human costs. It's then what does that mean for global terrorism? Again, we need to keep that in proportion. What does that mean for the structure of you know, geopolitics?
You know, I think really the interesting question, the most interesting question that this raises is what do we conceive of as our interests in the region? Because you started with using the phrase strategic interests.
Yeah.
But then there's clearly a humanitarian element here. And,
yes.
And not to pick on you about this, but it seems to me like, again, this is a real tension. How do we reconcile a less military-focused approach, an approach that perhaps isn't seeking to change regional outcomes all the time, but that nonetheless includes this kind of mandate for, say, humanitarian protection, for responsibility to protect and that kind of thing? It seems to me that those are very much in tension.
I think they potentially could be. But if you take, say, the new assertiveness of some of our partners in the region and allies and this increased initiative on their part, they're going to have an impact in some sort of way. By and large, if you look at places like Yemen, I think it's been negative. And it's in large part because of their actions and our unwillingness to use our leverage with them. So in the hypothetical where you take Brian's solution is we actually sit down with them in a very serious and focused way and quietly say, we're not going to, rather than have Congress do this, have an administration say, we're not going to continue to underwrite and sign blank checks here. Obama tried to do that for maybe, I think, 2 or 3 months on Yemen in a small slice towards the end of his administration. I actually think it could have produced better outcomes. And I'm not saying, you know, and I think the whole categories that we used to use for U.S. foreign policy debate, neocons or liberal interventionists, I'm not a liberal interventionist by any means. I think they need to be redefined. And in my view as an American, you do need to not only talk about interests in a clear way, but then also there has to be a values component to it. Otherwise, we're ceding the field globally to authoritarians and other groups. And as I say in the region, we're actually giving them, authoritarian countries, some of our closest partners, a blank check to reshape things in ways that I think are bad for us in the long run.
I struggle still, and I'm not saying I'm unconvincible, but I struggle with folks when I hear them say we have interests. And they tend to be a little vague about what those are, or that we need influence in the region, but I'm not exactly sure why or to what end. And, you know, I think what Emma was saying, I think is really the crux of it, which is, you know, if we had we need as a country a clear agreement about a clear enumeration of what we're trying to get done there. Is it cheap oil? Is it fewer people being killed by their governments? Is it peace between nations in the region? Is it to keep Iran in a box? To me, the United States is such a secure country. None of those things actually affect U.S. national security almost at all. And it's hard for me to understand why those things would push us to go kill people or sell or give weapons to other people to kill people. Those things are really important, not good things. And I need a really good reason to do them.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, it is U.S. security is about protecting our homeland and our citizens. And you don't need to have the footprint that we have in the Middle East today. You also don't need to simply go home, you know, and the phrase that the military now uses of working by, with, and through partners, I actually think is the right model. But my main point is that we're not actually using any of this leverage to produce better outcomes. So I think it improbable, like the U.S. is unlikely for a range of reasons to leave the field completely. But I think a sort of a gradual plan that says, look, we're trying to put in the building blocks where you guys are actually in control of your own situation. And easier said than done, right? Like we've written in our report also about this idea of a security, a regional security compact, Arab NATO, if you will, people have talked about. Easier said than done. But unless we're actually trying to use our tools towards some sort of longer term objective, that it opens the door to the U.S. sort of stepping back a bit, then I think it could result in a bigger cataclysm than what Syria produced in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. To what extent, Brian, do you think that the American discussion about interests in the region is distorted by the fixation that the United States seems to have on terrorism? Because that's one of the things that I sense is a go-to sort of blanket justification for the Yemens and the Libyas and the Syrias is that it's all about terrorism. And I think what I'm hearing from you is, that's a piece, but there are many bigger fish to fry. But it seems like the terrorism thing's getting in the way.
Oh, absolutely. It dominates our politics when we do pay attention to it, right? And I guess what I'm – and it's sort of the problems, threats, and challenges frame that drive our policy, unfortunately. And this is going to sound so Pollyannish and unrealistic, but I actually think there are many opportunities that the U.S. is missing when you think of the positive success stories in parts of North Africa, Tunisia, and other places where there's this – it has this distortionary effect. Like we are actually underinvesting in potential progress and success in places like Tunisia because we're overfunding things like expanding our footprint in West Africa for a military approach to defeat extremism. Whereas go back to this AEI project we're doing or the UN Human Development Reports, the building blocks for stability are things that actually we should be helping societies invest in educational systems and economic systems that actually are competitive and then can get linked up to the grid. And that's where even in our discussion here, but then our policy discussion gets so fixated on, well, what do you mean by security integrator? And I mean security integrator in the broader human development sense because, the waves of refugees that we've seen, I actually feel like we're on the leading edge of it. If you combine climate change, other factors that drive problems, it's not like we can wall ourselves off from it. Europe certainly can't. And I think in the long run, having a more holistic approach and building sort of political capital to do that is I think, a fundamental challenge.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. Thanks to our producer, Jeff Geld. If you like this episode, please consider writing us a review on iTunes. You can connect with us on social media using the hashtag FPPowerProblems. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.